Thursday, December 5th. You are tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes on this lovely, lovely, glorious Thursday. It's not snowing. It's not raining. It feels kind of gorgeous out there. But before I came into the studio, we tape our show for Friday, Thursday morning. And before I even tape my show on Thursday morning, I did get to hear Nancy Pelosi address America for a very short statement, very sober statement, that we will be moving forward with the articles of impeachment. Well, that was a slam dunk. You know, hearing started yesterday in Jerry Nadler's committee. I think it's Jerry Nadler, right? I think he's the
Jerry.
He's the head of the Judiciary Committee, and everyone was always so worried about how he was going to handle all the hearings. And it turns out it only got one. Anyway, I need to call Dave Schultz from yesterday. Really, really fascinating conversation with a professor from Hamline University, the professor of law as well as political science. And he made a recommendation that he thought that they should not go ahead with an articles of impeachment and send them over to the Senate, that rather what they should do is censure the president of the United States. So I have a question for you, Ken Barnes, and that is, will the fact that she is now suggesting that we are moving forward on the articles of impeachment, would that prevent them, though, just before they pass the articles, to do a sort of bait and switch and to move over and do a censure? So they plod. I mean, censure has to be out in front, or do you go through all this and say, you know, we're going to regroup, we're going to censure him?
Well, I think I'm not an expert, obviously, in congressional law, but my guess is that they can censure him at any time.
Exactly.
They didn't need to go through the impeachment process at all.
I mean, you could still move forward on that and then make a decision like, you know what, let's censure.
Yeah. Of course, the question is,
political call.
As Dave Schultz was telling us about why they might want to do censure instead of go forward with an impeachment trial in the Senate anyway, is how's it going to play out politically in the election, and the impeachment trial could be used against the Democrats.
What I meant was that they would be working on the articles of impeachment. They still have to vote on them, okay? So that still gives them time. And whether they could make the decision, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how quickly this moves. They're being told not to leave Washington this weekend.
The Democrats.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, everyone, I suspect. It'll only be the Democrats that will be voting on it. But, I mean, not that the Republicans aren't invited to participate, but they're probably going to be voting no. But isn't that's what I was told, was that they were told not to go away this weekend.
Yeah.
That really fast slam dunk.
Oops. Yeah. And they care that the Democrats aren't going to leave. And if the Republicans want to leave and not be there for the vote, that is their choice.
Arrivederci. All right.
But
anyway,
this weekend is still plenty of time.
Yeah. No, it's going to be – It was just very, very fast and very, very interesting. Anyway, your thoughts for today before we talk about debt and usury laws and whether we're burning people with debt and it's sort of a form of slavery, which to some extent I think it is. Anyway, what would you like to talk about?
First of all, happy birthday to my friend Baltazar Baca, whose birthday is today.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the talk about debt should be thought about, for me anyway, in the context of the gaps between rich and poor, the way our society, our politics, our economy serves the wealthy, and in particular, from a political point of view, how is it possible that people like Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg and the centrist Democrats, the party powers, can not take up Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders's article of faith, basically, that the important issue is whether our country's government is going to serve all of the people in the country or just the very few wealthy and powerful people.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I mean, maybe there's a way for them to still take centrist policies but at least acknowledge that fact. But if they aren't acknowledging that fact, then that is if they're saying it's fine to just bail out Wall Street and who cares if ordinary people lose their homes, how can they possibly get any support unless – progressive part of the party is doing a totally inadequate job of calling out the centrists on their failure to speak up about the gaps.
So no, I think that the moderates, the centrists, whatever we want to call them, they're not saying that they don't want to support people who are struggling. They do. They want to means test everything. That's what they want to do. They want to say that we will help you if you're making under $100,000, or we will help you. I mean, so they are offering some kind of financial support, which is dramatically different from what we're doing now. I mean, look at what Pell Grants do. They do very little these days. And look at the – I mean, so they are – saying it, my biggest fear, and you know this, is that once you mean test something and it becomes a welfare program, then it becomes more and more vulnerable. And what started out as a good idea becomes not a good idea because right. it just gets eroded and eroded. Look at Medicaid reimbursements, for example. Mm. You know, I mean, all these things. So the idea of universality is something that I actually embrace because rich people will always choose to do something more. Because they have the ability to do something more. They will go to Stanford. They will not go to UNH, you know, because they can afford it. Yeah. But I think that the idea that we at least say to everyone, there are certain basics of life here that we all are participating in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can opt out because of your wealth, but we know that everyone gets it.
Okay, but do you really – I'm not sure I know factually that you're right, that the only thing that the centrists are offering that's different from Sanders and Warren is to means test everything. Because I think that the centrists and Obama bailed out Wall Street and the auto industry, but he didn't save folks' houses from going under. And ordinary low-income people are still not back to feeling stable economically.
I don't disagree with that.
And I don't think that Buttigieg and Biden
are going to make them whole.
I don't think they're even talking about making them whole.
Let me just say something. So, but what are Bernie and Elizabeth making them whole? No, well, they're not talking. They're not looking back.
Bernie and Elizabeth say all the time that our the big problem that we need to address is that our government is working for the wealthy and not working so well for ordinary people. And ordinary people being defined all the way up to $100,000.
Believe it or not, if I listen to the Bloomberg ads and I listen to the Mayor Pete ads and I listen to the Biden ads, they kind of say that. I'm not defending them. They're not necessarily my choice, but I am saying that. To a large extent, they're incrementalists. And the problem I have right now is that incrementalists, given the nature of our problems and our crises, in some ways means moving backwards because mm-hmm. we have to move so quickly forward. And that what they're doing with their sort of slow, methodical movement is ultimately not really addressing the problem because the problem is growing bigger and faster than how they choose to move. And that's really what I see. So the question then becomes, it's like a balloon. You punch it in one side, it pops out the other. Right. My idea is let's pop the balloon.
Yeah, and I guess you and I don't necessarily see what this moment is in exactly the same way because for me, it seems like having the Democratic Party stand for what Warren and Sanders are saying, that all people in America should be served by our government and not just the very wealthy, is a very different thing from what the centrist Democratic Party is doing and calling for. And I don't really hear Biden
right.
saying that.
I don't disagree with that.
I think that this is the crucial moment where it actually can happen, that
right.
a large number of people will support the Democratic Party taking a more aggressive stand about the government being for everybody.
But let me just say something. The problem that a lot of people have is will that just mean that we'll all be eroded? And my question is, if we're all in it, maybe the idea is we won't be eroded because we'll all be participating, and then we have a vested interest in making sure that it is maintained. My problem is public education. Look at public education. Public education has acres of mediocrity and little pockets of excellence. And where are the pockets of excellence? It's public mm-hmm. education. So I look at that model, and I'm thinking, maybe I am a little more libertarian than you. I don't put as much stock in saying that everything that government does that they will do well because I've seen it not do well.
Oh, of course.
But
I'm not
also
saying
that either. Right. But and public education is a perfect example of who benefits from quality public education. And yet I go to Amherst, New Hampshire, and I go into mm-hmm. their schools, and I feel like I'm walking through piazzas and I'm walking through the finest private school in the world. Then I go to some place like, you know, Plainfield or I go to some place like, you know, Claremont, and I see moguls in the gym floor, and I see all this stuff, and they're both public schools. Screw you. That's mm-hmm, not public mm-hmm. education. That is the failure of wealth and lack of wealth. That's my concern.
Yeah, but for me, it's more the mindset, the message, and the taking a stand and saying what we stand for, just like you and I have talked many right. times about how Cory Booker is great at the message of right. what America should stand for. I think Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, their message, their gestalt of America should stand for a government that works for everybody right. and not just be focused on the very wealthy and the corporate elites.
I don't disagree.
And I think this is the moment where that has to actually become what the Democratic Party stands for.
Well, we better grab our guests because we got two of them.
Yes.
There was an article at the Atlantic Monthly, everyone, and this is so funny. So I tried to get a hold of the author, Libby Lewis, and I couldn't. But I happened to go on Twitter. And on Twitter, I saw her husband tweet, "My wife just wrote this great piece at the Atlantic Monthly." And I went, whoa. So I sent him a message through Twitter. And I said, "Could your wife join me on the air to talk about her article at the Atlantic Monthly?" And Libby Lewis, by the way, has actually talked on NPR. And she's actually been a reporter for them. So she has lots of facility and comfort in being able to do that. So we're going to be grabbing Libby Lewis, who wrote the piece entitled, listen to this, "Freedom is Meaningless Under Insurmountable Debt." Let me read this to you again. "Freedom is meaningless under insurmountable debt. Advocates are arguing that the 13th Amendment prohibits usurious loans." And she goes to this incredible history, which I found absolutely, absolutely fascinating. And let's be honest, if you are living and you cannot pay off your debt, you cannot afford to rent, you cannot afford to pay your bills, you cannot afford to buy to get a car, to have transportation, then as she writes out, "the condition of their lives raises the question, are these Americans fundamentally free?" So we're going to be grabbing our two guests. One is Libby Lewis, and she is with she wrote for the Atlantic Monthly. And then we're going to be grabbing the director of federal campaigns for the Center for Responsible Lending. Let me do this. I'm just going to play that song really quickly, and then we're going to listen to the radio. There you go.
I am leaving Mississippi and leaving the rain. These Delta towns wear satin gowns in a high beam train. The Red Alien guides my hands through the radio. Where would I be in times like these without the song of Loretta Rose? 'Cause when you can't find a friend, you still got the radio. When you can't find a friend, you still got the radio. The radio, oh, listen to the radio. The radio, oh, listen to the radio. Radio, oh. I left the Hanson to step the good old boy in Tennessee. Now he's sitting on the sofa, he's looking for his supper, wondering what's become of me. I got a 008 Tina Martin guitar in the backseat of the car. Hey, I am leaving Mississippi with the radio on. 'Cause when you can't find a friend, you still got the radio. When you can't find a friend, you still got the radio. The radio.
All right, don't hate me, everyone. This has been one of those crazy days. We're going to be calling both our guest from the Atlantic Monthly, as well as our guest from the Center for Responsible Lending, which anyway, it's been one of those crazy days. So the reason why I think Libby Lewis wanted someone from the Center for Responsible Lending was, in some ways, she wanted to sort of talk about sort of the nature of debt today, things like payday lending. What does it mean? What are the constraints? What are we doing? Is there a way to address this problem? As well as sort of focusing on her piece, which was much more historic in nature. So forgive me, everyone. I'm not quite sure what happened with the numbers, but we're getting both people on. So let's do this. We're going to get our first guest on, and then we're going to conference in our second guest, and we're going to go right to Libby Lewis with the Atlantic Monthly. So, Libby, you wrote this absolutely fascinating piece about the whole question of debt and whether, when people are overwhelmed with debt, are they actually free? And I just thought that that was so remarkable, given the fact that I know so many people who are in this vice between what's happening with student lending, with the unaffordability of housing, with the idea of payday lending because you can't meet your bills. So why don't you walk us through, before we grab in our guest from the Center for Responsible Lending, a little bit about this history, because I think the idea of freedom and debt is something that nobody has, or rarely have people connected the two.
I think that what's the best way to start? I think that what I wrote about for The Atlantic was to compare the situation with folks who have taken out these loans and get caught in these loans,
right,
with the situation that the Reconstruction Congress was considering after the Civil War, when they confronted how to deal with defining freedom, mm-hmm, for former slaves and indentured servants. And one of the critical things that they had to figure into that definition was labor. The core fundamental of freedom and of liberty is the right to own your own labor,
right,
and to do with your own labor what you will, and not to have that in the control of somebody else. So, so the Congress in Reconstruction had to come up with laws in order to how to enact that idea that was laid out in the 13th Amendment that banned slavery and involuntary servitude. And so they had to kind of spell out the way that they thought that that would be. And central to that is really the relationship of debt and labor to freedom.
So in your piece, you write, to many Northern Republicans like Howe, the aspect of freedom was woven in with other fundamentals of liberty, the ability to come and go as one pleased, to own property, and to be educated. So how to define the labor part of freedom, especially for people whose only property was their own body, and what that body could produce through work. So in a lot of ways, that was the essence. They didn't own anything. They didn't, historically, when you think of a slave, they don't have a history. Because they were bought and sold like they were a chattel.
Right,
and so as soon as they were freed, the only history they would have would be their present, and their present was their labor.
Right, right. And that's the only capital,
right,
they have.
Right.
It's the only thing they have. They don't have money. They don't have property. And so I think the analogy is for folks today, like the young woman who I wrote about who took out an auto title loan, which is a loan, it's a high interest rate loan that you take out and you sign over the title to your car as collateral. So if you fall behind, you can lose your car. And that can change your life, as we all know. But when you don't have other options, you're stuck in these situations where all you have is your labor.
Right, and car isn't a vanity choice. Car is,
right,
about getting to work. Car is about getting, mm-hmm, for food. Car is about, I mean,
yeah,
so in a lot of ways, and yet these loans are what was it, 300% interest. Now I want to turn to the Center for Responsible Lending. So is it
Graciela
Aponte Diaz, is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Okay.
Hi.
Hi. You're the director of federal campaigns, but you actually had spent a lot of time talking about payday borrowers and looking at the kind of protections that we need to have for these kinds of usurious loans. What happened to the idea that, you know, there was an interest rate that was too high? I mean, to me, at some point in time, I mean, I may bitch and moan about my credit cards at 21% or 18%, but when you look at a loan of 300%, that just doesn't even seem rational, let alone possible. And why would anyone even agree to that and think, if they did even a little bit of math, that they had the capacity to pay it off?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And, you know, for years we've had state usury caps in all states that didn't allow this. And little by little, back in the 80s and 90s, there's been deregulation among states to allow these payday loans and car title loans that you just talked about.
Right.
And also high cost installment loans. These are like $2,000 loans, a longer pay period, but 100-200% APR. So those are kind of the very predatory loans that are coming into states. I'm actually from a state that never allowed any of these, which is Maryland. New York is also like that.
Yeah.
Various states never had payday lending. And then I moved to California, where I was like, oh, what is this? 300%. Actually, they allow up to 459% APR loans. And the installment loans above $2,500 had no cap. And so it was about 2010 that lenders just started like flooding the market with 100% APR loans in that range. And so California was able to pass a rate cap just this year to stop that practice. I think the issue now that we're very worried about is that some predatory lenders are now partnering with out-of-state banks to evade rate caps that we are passing. And so that's what we're calling that, the rent-a-bank schemes.
Well, you know, I want to go back to Libby, because Libby, I think the idea of freedom and debt is such a powerful way of looking at it. Because I think if you do that, you actually get more people to sort of engage and weigh in. I was talking to someone the other day, and you will love this, and that is, I was talking about student debt, all right? And how student debt is becoming so outrageous, going on forever, that the amount of student debt people are required, especially if they're getting any kind of a degree over a bachelor's degree, is, you know, $100,000, $150,000. They don't even have a job yet. And they all have the equivalent of having bought a house, but they don't even own a house, you know? And I refer to student debt as the anti-dowry. And as I'm talking to you, what I'm realizing is that really, in a lot of ways, what do I mean by the anti-dowry is that, look at the choices of living that you cannot make.
Right.
You know, you can't choose to leave home because you can't afford a place to live. You can't choose to leave your job because you have to pay off that debt. You can't choose to get married because it would be about incurring more debt. So in a lot of ways, by looking at student debt and calling it an anti-dowry, it really does sort of go into that whole concept of the 13th Amendment.
It does, although it's a different student debt. I think it's a different situation than the debt that we're talking about today.
Oh, yeah.
Mostly because the students who take it out are doing it voluntarily. And that's not to say that they're not being subject to really horrific business practices among the lenders in the student loan community. But the kind of loans that we're talking about today are the ones that people take out so that they can eat or they can pay their rent.
Exactly. No, you're I mean, Graciello, as you hear Libby saying this, yes, it is a choice to sign that payday lending. I get it. Yes, it is a choice to sign over my car. I get it. But if there's no choice because you won't have shelter and you have children, and if there's no choice because you can't pay the food and you have children, then I guess the question is, what's your option?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I would say I agree, obviously there's a choice here, but there's two other things in play. One is actually aggressive marketing that's done to vulnerable communities so that they can't even see what the other options are. So you're concentrating these stores in African-American, Latinx neighborhoods. You're going through social media. I hear them on the radio all the time. You're like aggressively marketing. So you're missing out on like, oh, I can't pay my electric bill. I can call them and they can give me 1 month free. I can call the church. I can call the credit union. There's like all these other options that you're not seeing because of the aggressive marketing. And the other thing is these high-cost lenders, they want people to not have a living wage. Like, we're stuck in, we've got, like, increasing housing costs, increasing student debt. You know, we need rent control. We need living wage. And these high-cost lenders are out in states fighting against living wages. So it's like, okay, let's keep people needing these loans and dependent on these loans. And so that's a whole nother fight. Like, we need to help people so that they're not struggling and take these loans out of the picture so we can see what is actually available to help people. Because there's a lot of help out there, but nonprofits don't have the resources and the marketing dollars that these other guys have.
Could I offer a perspective here? I was a poverty lawyer, legal aid lawyer for quite a few years. And yes, I agree with you, Graciela. There are other options out there. I wouldn't say there's a lot of help out there because it's very difficult for poor people to actually find anybody that is willing to help them sufficiently to be able to subsist with their families. But here's the perspective I want to offer to answer Arnie's question about why would anyone sign these kind of usurious contracts. And I think my experience with poor clients is that they're really desperate for money now. It's kind of what Graciela is talking about. You really need it to pay the rent now. And you sort of have the perspective of, I'm desperate now. I'll get whatever money I can. Here's this option. And I'll figure out later how I'm going to pay my bills. I know I'm not going to be able to pay all my bills. And which one am I going to pay? Well, if the landlord is beating on the door and I'm 3 months behind and he's threatened to evict me, or she's threatened to evict me, then maybe I'll pay that bill and won't pay some other bill. And if I wind up going bankrupt, or, you know, what are they going to do? You can't get blood from a stone. It's sort of figuring it out later because you really don't have a choice, as Graciela was saying. You're desperate now.
Yeah, but let me just say something. In Libby's story, Libby, in your story, this person paid off thousands of dollars and still had not paid off their debt.
Right,
so even if
they
went in despair and said, take my car, by the time they took the car, they still had gotten lots of money out of the stone. I mean, the idea is that it's, and I think that's part of the problem. And I guess the idea of realizing that they ultimately, these payday lenders want to own you is what I'm hearing.
Mm-hmm.
That's what this is. This is about slavery. This is about ownership. And the way they own you is not only having you signing this piece of paper, but making sure that we don't raise the minimum wage, by making sure there isn't affordable housing, by making sure, you know, they can't afford health care. And then when you put all those pieces together, what's the difference? It is a form of ownership, Graciela.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, it's a cycle of debt, especially for the smaller dollar ones. For the larger dollar ones, it's a win-win situation, right? Like if they, you know, you've got I've seen $2,000 loans that balloon into $14,000. And if you, as a borrower, pay that for like 6 months, even you struggle to pay it for a year, you're paying like majority interest and nothing toward the principal. And you realize it and you're like, I'm going to get out of this. I'm going to get out of it. Mm-hmm. When you stop paying, what they can do is start collecting. They can start wage garnishment. If you go into bankruptcy, they can charge off that debt and get a break on their taxes for that charge off. So they've recouped their funds just with you paying it off for a year. So the people who actually pay it off after the 5 years and pay the $14,000, like, and I've seen that, that's a huge win for them. But that's not what they're expecting. They're expecting like a year or two of payments and charging them off.
So, you know, there's a law in New Hampshire, Libby, and the law says if there's a need, the town must provide. Most communities don't want anyone to know that in my state of New Hampshire.
Well, and they fight like hell to prevent you.
Right, exactly. But in a bizarre way, when you read your story, a lot of these people are making these unconscionable choices because it's either, you know, signing the payday loan or losing your home. You know, and that's not really a choice.
Right.
What again, I think is so interesting is people do have a choice in my state. They could actually go to the city or town, and the town should be able to help them with the mortgage payment or help them with the rent. But one, nobody knows this law, even though I know it. And on top of that, what I don't understand is that what happened to the idea of consumer protection, and what is the role of the government in protecting people from these kinds of – this is a form of abuse. Mm-hmm. This is an economic abuse, but it's abuse, Libby.
Yes. Although I think Graciela could speak to that more than I can in terms of what's happened to consumer protection, but it's really been devastated under the current administration.
But right after the Civil War and the Reconstruction, they knew that. You see, they what I read from your article was that the history was we understood human behavior. We knew what would happen once we freed the slaves. Knowing all that, that's one of the reasons why they sort of stepped in to protect these individuals and to make sure that kind of ownership wasn't going to be replaced by a different kind of ownership. What I'm just trying to figure out, and maybe Graciela, why isn't this the norm, and that it's not an accident of state or geography that people will recognize that this is abusive and a form of ownership? Why isn't this across the board?
Yeah. No, I mean it's hard. It's difficult. Like we've got 16 states plus the District of Columbia who have said no payday loans. We have a 36% rate cap, and that includes New Hampshire. That's and then we actually have 38 states that said we don't want any of the high cost installment loans, the larger dollar ones.
Right.
And so states are taking action and saying, we don't want this, but the predatory lenders are just finding loopholes to get back into the
right.
states to do these things. And so, you know, that's what we're fighting with the new administration right now. They're saying, oh, we're not going to regulate this. And so we actually, there's 20 states right now that have a rate cap where it's still happening because these predatory lenders are partnering with out-of-state banks out in Utah and other states.
It's disgusting. So we have to get rid of the weak links, those states like Utah. Again, I think the title should be a bumper sticker. Freedom is meaningless under insurmountable debt. That, to me, is something that would play well in every state. Thank you, ladies, so much for joining us. I really appreciate it, and I apologize. So thank you. Take care, Libby. Take care, Graciela.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, here we go. A little labor history is next.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2008. That was the day UE Local 1110 members at Republic Windows in Chicago began a 5-day occupation to protest the imminent closure of their plant. A month earlier, Republic workers witnessed management moving machinery out of the factory. They began monitoring where the machinery was going and soon learned it was headed for a new non-union plant in Iowa. They planned a possible plant occupation. By December 2nd, management announced the plant was closing in just 3 days. Republic Windows owner Richard Gelman blamed Bank of America for refusing to extend credit just as the federal government had bailed out the banks in a $700 billion deal. Workers learned they would receive no severance or vacation pay despite WARN Act mandates. The next day, they rallied out in front of Bank of America chanting, "You got bailed out, we got sold out." Workers were determined to occupy the plant that Friday when they went to pick up their last paychecks. Police refused to remove the sit-downers, and the occupation quickly made national news. Local labor leaders and trade unionists, activists, and politicians all visited strikers and lent their support. Journalist Carrie Leiterson recounts the events in her book, Revolt on Goose Island, noting the donations of food, blankets, pillows, sleeping bags, and other necessities that poured into the factory. Protests of Bank of America spread across the country. By the following Wednesday, workers learned that though they could not keep their plant open, they would at least win severance and vacation pay. In 2012, some of those workers reopened that plant under the name New Era Windows as a worker-run cooperative. They specialize in energy-efficient vinyl windows. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
The party's over. It's time to call it a day. They've burst your pretty balloon and taken the moon away. It's time to wind up the masquerade. Just make your mind up. The piper must be paid. The party's over.
We are back. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. Now, you picked the music, The Party is Over. Is that because of Nancy Pelosi's statement this morning? Was that the rationale for that?
The rationale is for Donald Trump. That
you think the party's over.
Your party's over. Yeah. Yeah.
Huh. Right.
I think he's caught.
You do. Stefan Schmidt, do you think he's caught? I don't think he's caught. If it's Thursday, it must be Stefan Schmidt, affectionately known as Dr. Politics from Iowa State. So grateful to have you on, especially after Nancy Pelosi's short statement with no, I guess it was not a press conference, because if you can't ask a question, it's not a conference. So what did you think of Pelosi this morning?
Well, it wasn't a press conference, but when a reporter basically insulted her by asking whether she hated Trump, she went after him and ripped out his throat. So Nancy Pelosi is not someone to be messed with.
No.
And the press conference or the announcement, I think it was very elegant. It was just very simple, you know, and the Democrats need to explain to the American people and to the Republicans that impeachment is not a civil offense. It's not a criminal offense. It's not a trial such as you would go into if you had one of those two. It is a constitutional offense. And that's very different, because I hear all these Republicans and President Trump and everyone else saying, oh, you know, this would never hold up in a court, and it's all hearsay and so on. That's really a smokescreen and a distraction, because you know, impeachment is a judgment call on whether a president has behaved in a way that, as the Republicans said with President Clinton, demeans the office of the president, is an insult to the American people and to the dignity of the Constitution. And the Democrats have not done a very good job explaining that.
Well, you know, this is so much more than demeaning the office, because this goes to the heart of what's going to happen in 2020, because it's about elections. So we already saw that he invited the Chinese and the Russians and everyone else into the 2016 election or whatever. And that was an invitation, but he didn't have power. He was still in the, I'm running for office mode. And whatever they did, it was really, I mean, Putin had to decide to do this. And for whatever reason, maybe he did it because he hated Hillary Clinton and nothing to do with, you know, Donald Trump. But what's going on with Ukraine and Biden is directly related to what's happening in 2020. He, in an interesting way, you know how we learn in gerrymandering that gerrymandering is about how politicians want to, you know, pick their voters as opposed to having the voters pick their, you know, their candidates. Well, I feel like in a lot of ways he's kind of trying to sort of – he wants to be able to pick off his opposition, and he wants to use Ukraine and shaking down Ukraine as a way to pick off his opposition. Well, that's just not done. That has to do with that's an election. He's actually hurting me by doing this, because he wants to sort of remove my ability to exercise choice, because he is going to harm the future election by what he's doing. And that's not his job. His job is to win, but his job is not to take away my ability to exercise choice by manipulating the outcome.
Yeah, I agree with you. But, you know, I wrote a piece for a great new online publication called The Conversation, which is all the articles are written by academics who were attacked, the lawyers, you know, the three lawyers that were attacked yesterday in the hearings. Academics write these articles. And I wrote one, they asked me to write it, on dirty tricks. Oh, my God. Arnie, you don't think there have been dirty tricks in almost every American election?
Of course.
And they, in many of those dirty tricks are as bad or certainly maybe worse than, you know, this particular dirty trick of, you know, having WikiLeaks release Hillary Clinton's emails and having sort of wink and a nod. There's no smoking gun that President Trump asked Putin to do this, though he said, yeah, you know, the Russians go ahead and get me that information about Hillary Clinton. And now there is pretty good evidence that he said to the Ukrainian president, get me that information on Hunter Biden. If you want me to give you some tools to deal with those Russian tanks. But dirty tricks have been an incredible part. Richard Nixon was a great dirty trickster, had all kinds of people, including Roger Stone, who is now in jail, do dirty tricks for him. Mayor Daley of Chicago famously let many, many dead people in Illinois vote.
And that's how Nixon complains Kennedy beat him.
That's right.
Nixon did complain about that.
Yeah, he did. And there's now some evidence that Mayor Daley probably didn't really have the, you know, the pull to do that. But so put it in perspective, dirty tricks have been part of politics. Politics is dirty. Politics is not the nice, clean thing that Arnie Arneson did when she was running for governor, because you should have used some dirty tricks against your opponent, Arnie. You might have won.
But they, and they used dirty tricks against me.
Did they?
Yeah, and well, we'll talk about that later. But that's another day and another story. But let me just say something. This is more than about dirty tricks in an election.
Yeah, this is
also about our national security.
Yeah.
Because one of the reasons why we're not giving money to Ukraine because we like Ukraine. I mean, let's be honest here. It has everything to do with what Putin did vis-a-vis the Ukraine. And this is really about – this is about military spending. It's about our security using them as sort of, you know, the moat before they get to us.
Yeah.
And so in a lot – and that's why Congress overwhelmingly supported it. That's why they wanted to do it. So this wasn't – this was about using our national security as a weapon for him for the 2020 election. So it wasn't just a shakedown for shakedown's sake. It had nothing to do with it. He doesn't care about corruption. He didn't even want them to do the investigation. He just wanted them to talk on CNN and suggest that there might be an investigation. Corruption's not his goal because he's corrupt. He doesn't want to find corruption, but he wants to use it to his advantage. He was using corruption to his advantage. He didn't want to clean anything up. He just wanted to shake them down. The problem is the way he shook them down wasn't with his money, wasn't with a contract with him. It was with our money, and it was about military assistance. That is the difference. That is about our collective vulnerability, and it goes far beyond even the 2020 election. And that's what makes it so wrong.
And it was also using Secretary of State Giuliani. Oh, wait a minute.
No, so, yeah, exactly.
Oh, not the Secretary.
Okay. No.
Pretend Secretary of State Giuliani, wannabe Secretary of State Giuliani, and a couple of shady other people that have been indicted now to kind of do backdoor break-ins, you know, kind of Watergate style into the Ukrainian administration to get them to do this. And you know what's interesting, and I know you probably don't want to hear this, but it really is going to help Joe Biden.
Yeah.
Joe Biden's poll numbers are holding up.
Absolutely.
He's getting endorsements. You know, John Kerry endorsed him just today.
Really?
Because
it
shows that Trump and his people really are afraid of Joe Biden. They call Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas and, you know, little Bloomberg and all that. But they're really afraid of Joe Biden. So in some ways, at least, he got caught trying to do something that in some respects may backfire on him completely. and produce the opposite of what
actually,
he was
this
hoping.
Actually, there was something that was said the other day that, you know, Hunter Biden has always lived off his father's name. He really has never been an independent, accomplished human being, unlike his other son.
Unlike Bo.
And I think to a large extent, and we actually see that with this contract. I mean, he had no skill set for that contract. He didn't have anything. What he had was his father's name. And that's what he was selling. He was selling the illusion of access to power, even if Joe said, I'm not talking to you. Okay? It doesn't matter. People didn't know that. All they would see is the word Biden, and he was on the board of directors, and that would open doors. You know that because we've seen it today. Oh, you're a Kennedy. Oh, you're a this. I mean, it's the way we do business everywhere. Someone wrote that maybe the greatest accomplishment of Hunter Biden will be these impeachment hearings. That what he did was he was the excuse, the driver of going into Ukraine and looking for some corruption, connecting Hunter to his father, whether it's real or Memrex, who cares. But as a result, we had what happened this morning with Nancy Pelosi, and you will see the articles of impeachment being filed against Donald Trump. That would not have happened with the Mueller report. It did happen because of Hunter Biden. And then I want to go to what you just said. So what you just said is that it may backfire and that, in fact, John Kerry just came out today and endorsed Joe Biden. Well, it turns out that Hunter Biden may have been the only asset that Joe Biden ever really had going into 2020. Because although Joe Biden, you know, is trying to run as Obama light, he is running sort of as the extension of Barack Obama. And for at least a number of people in the black community, they have a sense of relationship and safety and security with him that they do not experience with everyone else. And then to have someone like a John Kerry who comes out today and talks about how he's going to really fight for climate change. And I'm thinking, really, how's Biden going to do that? And then he endorses Biden in the same breath. I mean, explain that to me.
Well, that's true. But come back to the fact that the African-American community and black community likes Biden. Kamala Harris just dropped out of the race. Surprising. Cory Booker is not getting traction with the black community. It kind of undermines the narrative that I hear here in Iowa from a lot of Democrats, you know, which has to do essentially with ethnic and other constituencies that you have to appeal to. And Kamala Harris is proof that that doesn't necessarily work. You know, voters make independent decisions when they answer polls. They're not necessarily focused on race, which I think to some extent is really wonderful. I mean, you know, the fact that the black community doesn't demand a black candidate for president, I mean, that shows you that they're making other judgments and other decisions, whether they're the right ones or not. I don't know.
One question, Stefan, is what questions are the black voters being asked? If they're being asked, do you support Biden over Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, whoever, Pete Buttigieg, then that they're going to give a very different answer, especially knowing as little about the candidates if they haven't come to your state yet. But when it comes to the general election, the question is that African-American community going to actually turn out, or are they going to stay home like they did in 2016?
Well, let me just say something else, though. Right. The difference is that Barack Obama was not supported in places like South Carolina until he won Iowa.
No.
True.
You know that. Right. You know that. And what they needed confirmation because they felt comfortable with Bill and Hillary. They knew Bill and Hillary. Yeah. I mean, you know, the joke was that Bill Clinton was the first black president, even though he wasn't. So there was a relationship there. They felt comfortable there, and they never thought it was possible. And then when they were able to dream because he won Iowa, then they could see that dream be possible for them. Mm-hmm. And so the problem I have right now with Corey and Kamala and Julian and all, you know, virtually the diversity on the Democratic stage doesn't exist anymore, is that there isn't anyone to win in Iowa because of Biden, because of Bernie, because of, you know, the two people I said that should not have run, because they've really sort of occupied the stage. And instead of allowing new voices and new visions to emerge, they haven't. And they're sort of defining this race. And therefore, no surprise that they're going to go with Biden because Biden is what they know.
Well, you still have Pete Buttigieg emerging. Why doesn't Corey emerge?
Yeah, that's a good question. Why is Pete emerging and not Corey? That's a really good question. Can you answer that for me, Stefan?
Wall Street?
No, Wall Street has almost zero influence in Iowa in the polls anyway.
Right.
And you know, Mayor Pete is doing okay in the national polls in Iowa. He's way ahead because Iowa liberal Democrats are very progressive. They like the idea, you know, of somebody younger and somebody who is diverse, at least in terms of being gay. They're very progressive, and so you know that's the main reason. But I'm not sure that Mayor Pete is going to surge forward and win the Iowa caucuses. You know, we'll have to see that. February 3rd. That's a long time from now. Still,
you just made an interesting statement, though, that they're very progressive and they like something new.
Yeah.
Well, Cory Booker is, you know, he's a man of color. He's diversity.
Yeah.
He's articulate. Yeah. He comes from Newark. He ran a bigger city than Mayor Pete. You know, I mean, Mayor Pete is young. Yes, I will agree with you. He's gay. Yes, that's his piece of diversity and his youngness.
Yeah.
But when it comes to his ideology and his issues,
right,
he's not progressive.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to figure out, other than being gay and young, and if that were – if that were enough, he's smart.
And smart.
Oh, he's
wicked
smart.
He answers questions better than anyone when he's asked, when he's, you know, has a good presence. We don't like New Jersey and Iowa, so, you know, there's a strike against you right there. And American voters, including Iowa voters, don't really kind of shimmy up to Acela corridor candidates from the Northeast who, you know,
yeah,
or they're too northeastern, you know.
But him being smart, you know, Stefan, him being smart, Corey's a Rhodes Scholar. Elizabeth Warren is as smart as Pete, and so is Amy Klobuchar, and she's a Midwest person.
Yes,
well,
that's true.
Yeah,
but they don't have the other qualities that he has. For some reason, Klobuchar has not run a good campaign. Kamala Harris, I mean,
figured out her issues.
Well, look at all the things she has. She had her sister running one half of her campaign and a Hispanic running the other half, and they were at war with each other. The story is that the campaign treated campaign workers horribly. She never had a theme. She never could focus on anything. She kept zigzagging. She attacked Joe Biden in that debate, which pissed off a lot of Biden supporters and Democrats who didn't want the war to begin that early. So, you know,
exactly,
she kind of blew it. It's too early to tell how that all is going to go.
All right.
But for now, going forward, the question is, what's going to happen with impeachment? Well, I think the House will vote for impeachment. The Senate will hold a trial, and they won't get enough Republicans to vote with 100% of all the Democrats in the Senate who are going to vote for confirming the impeachment and removing the president. And so Donald Trump is going to go down as one of the few presidents in American history to have been impeached. I don't think he will be convicted.
Well,
but it'll be fascinating to see, you know, the whole drama of impeachment going forward, the accusations. It'll create more polarization. It'll maybe, you know, excite the Democratic base, but it'll also excite the Republican base if they go forward.
Actually, I have a question for you.
And then it'll
you.
Be over
yeah.
with, you know, in January or February, and maybe earlier, it'll be done with. It'll be, you know, and Donald Trump will still be president, and he'll be saying, you see, they impeached me because they hate me, and Nancy Pelosi.
But I survived.
That'll be the new T-shirt. I was acquitted.
Right. They lost. I won. That will be the T-shirt.
No,
they
it'll be
lost,
justice
I
prevailed. I did nothing wrong.
Yeah. Exactly. So I have one quick question as I was thinking about this, because who, in fact, is responsible for this trial is Justice Roberts, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Does that mean that the Supreme Court goes on hiatus while he is sitting in the U.S. Senate? I'm curious about what happens to the court. The court has such a thick docket. It has a lot of work to do. They can't afford to not have the Chief Justice be there because then it'll be eight justices. So I'm kind of curious what happens to the court while he is participating in the impeachment over in the Senate. Do you have any idea?
Yeah, he plans to tweet his answers to the court.
Oh.
on cases that they're doing. He says if the president can rule the country by tweet,
I can do my Supreme Court work with my Twitter account. No, that would be that's really I got to find someone who can answer that question.
You know,
for
people
me.
Said the that same thing about the senators. I mean, Elizabeth Warren is going to be captured having to be there and not on the campaign trail.
Exactly. But more importantly, and we're talking about the chief judge. I mean, I hate to say this, it'll be important. Now, really quickly before I let you go, because we did mention that John Kerry just endorsed Joe Biden. You mentioned it at the beginning of this conversation.
Yeah.
I'm looking at an article from The Guardian. Quote, I keep my promises. How Biden is using the climate crisis to appeal to rural voters, joining with former Agricultural Secretary Tom Vilsack, the former governor of Iowa, a hero among tall corn state Democrats. Biden vows to pay farmers to sequester carbon. Did you know this? I keep my promises, he says. And he's I just love it. He's running around with Vilsack and saying, so that's why rural folks should vote for me.
And Vilsack is not well liked by tall corn Democrats. He was big agriculture. And I can tell you right now, a lot of progressive liberal Democrats, even moderate Democrats, you know, didn't like Vilsack as governor or certainly as ag secretary. But he does have name recognition. And it's funny, you know, sequestration. I mean, the poor corn farmers are going to go probably ask the extension office, you know, what is sequestration and how do we do that? And is it going to make more money for me than selling corn and beans on the market?
Wow. They said, Vilsack is among the leaders of an unorganized cadre of politicians, farmers, scientists, and journalists pushing for a different approach from 50 years of rural decline. They're getting across the idea to all presidential candidates of paying farmers for environmental services, something that the Iowa Farmers Union and the Iowa Farm Bureau have preached from opposite pulpits for close to 30 years. So who knows? He keeps his promises, he says, and I got Vilsack right next to me. Thank you so much for joining us, Stefan. It'll be interesting to find out, what does Chief Justice Roberts do? What does the Supreme Court do? All right,
well, you know, he has four or five law clerks.
They can do the heavy lift. All right, talk to you later. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
And we end with?
We end with, we've been through some crappy times before. That's the title of this tune by the Austin Lounge Lizards.
Oh.
Yes, we've been through some crappy times before, and somehow the country has survived, so we'll survive this too.
All right.
You say the last elections didn't turn out like you planned. You're feeling blue and clueless, you just don't understand. You're sad and sulky, somber, sullen, moping and morose. You're woeful, doleful, weak and weary, semi-comatose. You stare at your computer screen, devoid of joy and hope. You're so depressed you can't get dressed, you're noosing up a rope. But just remind yourself when you can't stand it anymore that we've been through some crappy times before. We've been through some crappy times before. Slavery, unbridled knavery, and the Civil War. Don't stop caring, stop despairing, get up off the floor. 'Cause we've been through some crappy times before.